Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, thank you for joining me as we continue to go through the big old binder of baseball cards. We're in the 1950s and rapidly moving through that decade because I only have several cards from that decade. And in fact, today's set I only have one card for, but it's one of my favorite cards because I've got a pretty fun story behind it. And there's a very fun story behind the person featured on that card, and that is Mr. Jerry Staley, card number 412. Now, Jerry Staley is not exactly a household name unless you are an incredibly diehard St. Louis Cardinal or Chicago White Sox fan. And when I say diehard, I mean you know the ins and out of your favorite team going back 60, 70 years, as the case may be. As Jerry Staley started his career with the Cardinals, didn't finish with the White Sox, but a very interesting story about what happened to him, what kept his career going, and also what he did afterwards. And I've got to give some credit to the Sabre people, and of course, SABR.org. Somebody did a phenomenal write-up on Jerry Staley. I could have used my usual resources of baseballreference.com and the occasional Wikipedia search and my own knowledge about players, but the Sabre people really pulled together an incredible story about Jerry Staley. So we'll talk about that and the great 1958 top set. Great in a different sense from 1957, and I'll explain why in just a little bit. First, I want to thank everybody who has listened to the podcast this past week. We had a huge number for our 1957 Tops podcast featuring Pee Wee Reese, or the remnants of the Pee Wee Reese card that I've been able to keep together all these years. Hey, after all, like I said, I bought it for 50 cents, I think, at a garage sale, and it was my one tangible non-recreation connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers. And my dad grew up in Brooklyn. He watched the Dodgers. They moved to Los Angeles when he was 15. So I got the inside scoop on what it was like being a Brooklyn Dodgers fan in the late 40s and early 50s when they, you know, had this nice resurrection. They were actually the talk of the town for that one magical year in 1955. And it's just cool to actually have a relic from that team, and of course a great baseball player too in the form of Pee Wee Reese. Also, I want to thank those who checked out our Flashback Friday episode. We're going way back to the early days of the podcast, way back to like August, but it does seem a while ago when we look back at the 83 Fleer set, one of my favorites, and the first of many great sets, particularly in the 1980s for Fleer. I was never a big fan of the 88 and 89 sets. They were good, but not great. But really, if you look at 1983 through 1990, Fleer put out some really good sets, and 83 Fleer is one of my favorites, not only because the people at Fleer finally got it right, but also you had such a great rookie class. You had a lot of great young stars coming up from the late 70s and early 80s, and it was really a fun set. Even though I only have a small handful of cards from that set, it was a fun set to go looking back at. And in case you're a little late to the news, the reason why we're doing Flashback Friday episodes is we've reduced the number of Wax Ecstatic podcasts to just one a week for right now. That may change, but gives me a little bit of a breather, gives you, the listener, a bit of a breather. We have more than 70 episodes now, so if you're just joining us or you just joined us within the last month or two, trust me, I've heard from plenty of you. You're catching up with all the past episodes, and you know, with some of these running 45, 50 minutes. You know, you do the math. You take that, multiply it by 70. That's an awful lot of time to devote to listening to the old episodes. And I do appreciate it. It's great that you're going back and listening to some of these. But we're going to let you catch your breath as well by featuring a flashback episode on Fridays. And we'll, of course, send out Twitter notifications on Saturday and Sunday just to remind you that those episodes are the ones we're spotlighting over the weekend. Now, speaking of Twitter news, we will post this as well. In fact, as you hear my voice, you've probably seen this tweet already. But I can finally share the exciting new platform news that I've been waiting a couple weeks to share with you. I didn't get official notification until a few days ago, and I decided to wait until the show. As you know, we are available at audioboom.com or the Audioboom app. Just search Wax Ecstatic, and there you are. We, of course, send out links to our podcast via Twitter. We can be heard on iTunes, and that's just a wonderful thing there. We really were able to expose our show to a lot of collectors through iTunes. Well, now we've got another option for you, and I'm very happy to say you can listen to Wax Ecstatic and all of our archived podcast via the iHeartRadio app. That's right, iHeartRadio has the app. Chances are you already have it on your phone. It's real easy. Just click the search window and type in Wax Ecstatic, and we'll show up. It's not a live streaming station like most of the iHeartRadio stations are. They do podcast as well, and I've got to thank my friend Chris Peterson, who is heading up a lot of the podcast work at iHeartRadio. Chris and I go back a ways back. He used to work at TuneIn. He's a big Tampa Bay Lightning fan, so we've had plenty of conversations about my employer, the Tampa Bay Lightning, but also about technology and mobile listening and stuff like that. He was able to show me the way to get it on iHeartRadio, so I appreciate that, Chris Peterson, and appreciate the work you're doing at iHeartRadio. So, everybody, make sure you tell your friends you can listen to us via Audioboom, you can listen to us via iTunes, or you can listen to us via iHeartRadio, again, the iHeartRadio app, or iHeartRadio.com. Click on the search window, just type in Wax Ecstatic, and save us as a favorite. Now, as for some of the commentary from Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, we've got some interesting comments from this past week. Our friends at Cardboard Clubhouse says, picked up this lot of packs for 50 cents each at a card show last weekend. And they sent a picture. Let's see. We've got a rack pack, and it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 packs. And, you know, you've got, you know, 2006 Topps, 2005, I believe, Donruss. But then you've got the good stuff right after that. Looks like a 92 Donruss over here in the corner. But 86 Topps Cello, 86 Topps Wax, and 83 Topps Cello. 86 Donruss Wax, 89 Topps Cello Pack, you know, 50 cents each. I mean, how many did we have here? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. I mean, $6. That's the beauty. I know people call it the junk wax era, but you can get for $6 a lot of packs, and you can just have fun ripping through them and seeing what you got. Well, for $6, what if you pull a Jose Canseco out of that 86 Donruss pack? Yes, nowadays, that card is probably worth only $6. Not that long ago, it was about $60. But you could get a Canseco rookie. Or in that 83 Topps, you can get, hello, Tony Gwynn, Ryan Sandberg, Cal Ripken Jr., the big three from 1983. There's all sorts of possibilities there. So I absolutely love that about the quote-unquote junk wax era. And if you know where to look, whether it's a card show or a community yard sale or even sometimes on eBay, you'll find somebody, and I did this not that long ago. I used to have a lot of wax boxes from, I shouldn't say a lot. I had one each of like 89 Topps, 90 Topps, 91 Topps, and much like all the other cards I had in my house, I was just tired of carrying them around. And, you know, I put them up on eBay, and I basically just, you know, put up a price up there that covered shipping and maybe gave me a dollar back in return. And they moved like hotcakes. So sometimes you find somebody that is just looking to part with a wax box of 87 Topps for, you know, $9 with shipping just to get it out of their house or their warehouse or whatever the case is. And you can still find some real gems there. Now, speaking of finding real gems, Ryan Irving, I love this, sends me a picture. A couple years back, I picked this one up on eBay just for fun. And it's a 57 Topps. I believe it's Sandy Koufax. And I say I believe it's Sandy Koufax because this card is quite literally ripped in two. And all you see is the smiley, happy face of Sandy Koufax looking back at you. Now, in terms of monetary value, there's not much here. In fact, I'd venture to say it's zero. So I don't know. I hope you didn't pay too much for it. But that really is a just for fun thing. You can say, hey, I've got a 57 Topps Sandy Koufax. Okay, I've got the top half of a 57 Tops Sandy Koufax, but I've got one nonetheless. So a very nice find there. CompleteYourSets.com. If I listen to these podcasts about cards from the 50s and 60s, I'll have to loosen my mint standard and buy some in lesser condition. And of course, I commented back. I said, do it. Actually, really, it should have been if I could add my voice to it. Because that's one of the down things with Twitter. You can't really add emotion to it. So CompleteYourSets.com, let me put it to you this way. Do it. You won't be disappointed. First of all, trying to find anything mint from a 1950s or 60s set, it's out there. You can find it. But especially now with the professional grading, you know, that ramps up the value so much more to where, sure, you could spend $500 for one semi-star card from 1957. Or, and I just did an eBay search on this, and, you know, I like to do what I call window shopping. I'll just search for stuff, keep it on my watch list, and then I don't buy it. But, you know, it's just kind of fun to kind of go through it. And sometimes maybe some item or items I'm looking at actually do come in at a pretty good price and I jump on it. But for $500, you could get probably about 500 or 600 cards from the 50s and 60s in various lots. And all you do is, you know, you go into eBay and you just type in, lot of 1950s Topps baseball cards, or type in a specific year. You like 62 Topps, type in lot of 1962 Topps baseball. Now, you'll have some people who are going to try to nickel and dime you, but then you have some people. They have a lot of 100 cards. Of those 100, maybe 22 are from 1962, but it's in the description of the product or the title. And it's actually a lot of cards from like 1959 to 1968. And they're not in mint condition. They're not in near mint. In fact, you could argue they're kind of borderline very good to excellent. But if you're like me and you just want these tangible pieces of history, some really nice cards, and maybe you too can have that Sandy Koufax 1957 Topps card. Although if you want to spring a little more money than Ryan, you get the whole card. But maybe it's beaten up. At least you could say, hey, I've got a Sandy Koufax rookie card right here. And that's how I am. You know, again, you know, I'm not really looking for the big name cards. I mean, if there's a good player that's in a lot, that's great. Like I bought a lot of, I think the total was about 400 cards, all from the early 70s. They were 71 through 79. Actually, yeah, it was through all of the 70s. But the bulk of the cards were 74 to 79, which I already have quite a few of. But I was able to get this lot of, you know, again, very good, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 5 to 6, most of the cards were. You had some that could be 8 or 9, others that were 2. But I was able to get this lot of cards with shipping for like $18. Now, I got lucky. Sometimes you don't get that big of a deal. But I got 400 cards for like $18 with shipping. And while I'm going through these cards, you know, there's a 73 Topps Steve Carlton. Now, was it in gem mint condition? No, but it was in pretty decent enough condition to where I said, wow, that's still worth a little bit of money. And hey, I now have a 73 Topps Steve Carlton card to add to my collection. So, you know, again, everybody collects by their own needs, their own wants. But if you're just somebody who just wants older cards, just to look through them, see them in person, maybe you never had old cards before, or maybe you're too young to really have access to older cards that weren't bolted down in the big, you know, 3/4 inch card holders. Getting a lot of older cards from the 50s and 60s and 70s for a cheap price and just kind of thumbing through them and seeing what you got, knowing that you're buying them just because they're cool cards and not because you're looking to make a fortune off of them, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, I highly endorse it because I do it. And what Uncle Matt says, you do, kids. All right, finally, Peter K. Steinberg, your Bobby V voice sounds a lot like David Price's voice. Excellent podcast and recent 57 Tops. Thank you. Well, thank you, Peter. And, you know, I'd have to listen back to David Price. I mean, he's been missing from Tampa Bay for, what is it now, 3 years. And ever since he signed with Boston, I've kind of tuned him out, not because I'm mean. It's just I've seen what markets like Boston, what the fans and the media do to players who were, you know, treated with kid gloves in Tampa because nobody wants to ask a hard question or no fan really wants to, you know, press any issues. So I certainly wish David Price the best. God help him if the Red Sox get to the playoffs and he can help them advance a round or two. But of course, the Bobby V voice in regards to the commentary in our last podcast, which was all about the introduction to baseball cards, the VHS video that a listener sent a copy of the cover. And we had a link, we found a link on YouTube to the video. And again, the content of the video for a 1988 VHS how-to on collecting baseball cards, the content actually was not that bad. And I really have to stress that because, I mean, we're all collectors. We all know what we're doing, right? Well, here's a VHS tape from 1988. Bobby Valentine is the host of the show. You're going, oh, good Lord, you got to be kidding me. But the content was not that bad. It was actually very informative. It wasn't too campy. The tough part was having to listen to Bobby Valentine talking about all the cards you can get in 1988. And you can still get all those cards in 2017. There's plenty of 1988 stuff floating around there. But I'm glad you like my impression of Bobby Valentine. And if I can ever get Bobby Valentine's impression and Harry Carey's impression into a bar joke together, if I'm really bored one day, and that could happen come July or August, then perhaps we'll do something with that. All right, if you want to do something with Wax Ecstatic, just send us your comments at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. We're open 24/7, and you can talk about our podcast, talk about the players we discuss on the podcast, talk about the sets, or just talk about anything in the hobby. Again, if you collect now or if you collected back in the day, you're not as big of a collector as you used to be. That's the type of person I am. I still buy new cards every now and then, but nowhere near what I did when I was like 13, 14 years old. It's still fun to look back at these sets, look back at some of the finds that other collectors have found, and certainly share that with other collectors. Again, past, present, and who knows, maybe even future. And don't forget to share the news that, again, you can listen to new episodes of Wax Ecstatic every Tuesday. We post them at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at Audio Boom, at iTunes, and now on the iHeartRadio app. All right, so let's look at our chosen set. It's from 1958, the 58 Topps set. And our random pull, again, to be upfront and honest, is not very random. I have one card from the 1958 Topps set, which is actually amazing. Because like I've said, I've gone out and bought lots of, you know, small lots, but lots of cards from the 1950s and 60s. Yet amazingly, I still have this one card. So, I don't know, maybe I'll spring a few dollars to pull in a few extra 58 tops to help poor Jerry Staley find some friends here. But this is one of my favorite cards because it's a cool set, different cool factor than 1957, but I've got an interesting story about this particular card. Let's look at the set, though, as the 1958 top set came out with a much larger size than 1957. We mentioned how the 57 set was groundbreaking in that they used real color photography shots. They were all pose shots, but real color film kept it to a very basic design, but also, more importantly, the size of the card being dropped down to 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches, that is the standard that is still in effect today. Well, the top set is numbered to 495. Numbered, that's the key. I'll get to that in just a little bit. But this is much larger than what you saw in 1957. In fact, it's almost over 90 cards larger. And for pretty good reason. First of all, you have the brand new Sport Magazine All-Star cards. And I'm old enough to remember Sport Magazine, and I'm old enough to remember that even in the 90s when I got Sports Magazine, it was kind of coming down the totem pole in terms of impact and importance in the sports world. Of course, you had the Sporting News and Sports Illustrated were still going very, very strong in the early 90s. Sport Magazine, not so much. But that was a co-branded All-Star card. And it gave collectors a chance to get two cards of some of their favorite players. And, of course, you're talking about the best of the best. Also, the 58 top set featured several multiplayer cards. For example, there's a card with Mickey Mantle and Hank Aaron taken during the 1957 World Series at Yankee Stadium. And they're posed next to each other holding up a bat, and it says World Series batting foes. So you have these combo cards that were mixed in as well. And you also had a neat little addition to the 58 top set, team checklist cards. And this is one of the toughest cards to get in mint condition these days, because again, in 1958, kids actually used the checklist for a checklist. They marked up those cards left and right. So finding a near mint checklist card is very hard to do. And it's not just in 1958. You could even say in 1978, you know, kids were still using these as checklist pieces up until the early 1980s when people started assigning values to them. Then they stopped using the actual checklist cards for a checklist. Now, I said that the set was numbered to 495. That's because it's missing a card. Now, it's not missing because there was an error in printing. Sometimes, like the early 1950s top sets, and Bowman did this as well, they would purposely take out a couple of card numbers from the circulation so that you could say, oh, it's a 400 card set. And people trying to collect it would just keep buying pack after pack after pack after pack, trying to complete the set. When in reality, there were 393 cards. There were just seven cards that were never made. Of course, the company would never make that news public. Well, in 1958, there was supposed to be a card number 145 featuring Ed Boucher, who was with the Philadelphia Phillies at the time. Well, during the 1957 offseason, he was charged and convicted of exposing himself to underage girls. So, you know, we talk about athlete problems nowadays. This is 60 years ago. So, you know, it's not like, you know, it was all just, you know, innocence galore in the 1950s. I mean, you had your pervs too. So the Topps Company, realizing that they probably shouldn't be marketing a baseball card, even though Ed Boucher was not Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays or anything like that, they realized it wasn't a really good business decision to market a collector card to kids of a guy who admitted to exposing himself to underage girls. So they pulled the card. Now, interesting sidebar about Ed Boucher. So he admits guilt, or he pleads guilty, I guess I should say. And he got 3 years probation, and he had to serve time in a mental facility. And that was it. He was actually allowed back into baseball. And he played, I think he started playing again in 1961, I want to say. I may be off on that, but there was a gap in his playing career. And he was actually a member of the 62 Mets. Believe it or not, you know, the Mets in the expansion draft ended up picking up a pervert. And everybody knew it at this point in time. It's not like, you know, it was, you know, figured out many years later. But boy, how times have changed. I mean, if an athlete these days does the same thing and goes up as guilty on those charges, my goodness, 3 years probation and mental health facility. Yeah, I mean, they would be, you know, first of all, the judge would probably be throwing him into prison, but there would be such an outcry. But, you know, times have changed. The word probably didn't get out too much. And the fact that Ed Boucher was a, you know, lesser known player for a somewhat not really good Philadelphia Phillies team, that probably got under the radar a lot more than any other athlete. Now, the 58 top set, to get back onto the main track here, of course, you've got some incredible star cards, some young rookie cards. You also have the first Topps card of Stan Musial. Yep, Stan Musial for years held out. He didn't sign the contract. Obviously, whatever Topps or in the past, whatever Bowman was offering was not enough. Well, finally, he came around in 1958. So if you're looking for your first Topps card in a time where Stan Musial only had, I believe, three more seasons left in his career, well, there you go. You can find your Stan Musial quote-unquote rookie card. Now, real rookie cards, while not as impressive as 1957, you've got some pretty good ones in the 58 set as well, including Roger Maris, Orlando Cepeda, and also Curt Flood. Now, the Curt Flood card, not worth a whole lot of money, but if you follow the history of baseball, you know how indispensable Curt Flood was to the Major League Baseball Players Association. And every baseball player who is paid, you know, these $30 million a year contracts, or even on a lesser extent, you know, you're a utility infielder, you're still getting $2.5 million to, you know, appear in 60 games. You owe Curt Flood a debt of gratitude because he was one of the early challengers to the old reserve clause, and he paid a major price, not only because he was challenging the old guard with the reserve clause, but as a black ball player in the late 1960s doing the stunt, that was not very well received, not just by baseball owners, but by a lot of people. Now, there's also some interesting variation cards in the 58 top set. The most common variation is the player's name was written on the base set in white letters, but sometimes they came out yellow. Now, I don't know if this is necessarily a purposeful variation or just happened to run in the press like this for a few sheets. But those yellow letter versions are much more valuable than the white letter versions. Also, there are some that have different background colors, and we'll get into the colors in a moment. But the best example is the Hank Aaron card from 1958, where the background on his base card was a dark green. Well, there is a variation out there that is light blue, and obviously the light blue variation fetches a lot more money than just the standard 58 tops Hank Aaron card. Not that a Hank Aaron card wasn't going to fetch enough money anyways, but now you've got this super rare variation, and it does make a big difference. Now, as for the card that we have here, card number 412, and yes, this would be considered a high series card, which makes my ownership of it even more impressive, and again, I'll get to that in a moment. But Jerry Staley here, I've always loved the look of this card, first of all, because the Chicago White Sox logo in 1958 was this flying sock. It's as strange as that sounds, and you can see it in the picture that we feature here. It's a flying sock with wings, a winged sock on top of a upside-down black triangle. And I've always liked this logo because it looks like it should be on the front of a Goodyear tire store. And Jerry Staley just looks like a Goodyear mechanic on this card. You could, if you were to wipe out the words pitcher in Chicago White Sox at the bottom, you could put Goodyear store manager or manager of the year, 1957. And it would fit. It just has this very wholesome, aw shucks look to it. And the story behind Jerry Staley has an aw shucks feeling to it as well. But I've always liked just the simple look of this card. And 1958 Topps was a very simple set, but different from 57 Topps. As we mentioned, 57 Topps, it was all about the pictures. And that was the first set to use full color photographs. Just that was it on the front of the card. And then you had just a little space for the player's name and the team that he played for at the bottom. Well, the 58 Topps set, you have real photographs, but instead of showing the player in his natural habitat, so to speak, as they make him sound like a zoo animal, basically what they did was they cropped out the background and put the real photo on top of a color background. So it was almost like a matte painting where you have the real thing up front and then just this phony background behind him. So in the case of Jerry Staley, you've got Mechanic Jerry here, and he is featured in front of a yellow background, a very bright yellow background. Now, the white letters would not look good on a yellow background, so they used red letters here. And at the bottom of the card, you not only have that unique White Sox logo, but you also have his position at the lower left, and on the right side, you have the team that he plays for. And this was a very basic look here. It's just Jerry Staley smiling at the camera, and there's a yellow backdrop right behind him. Now, even though this is not as innovative or as groundbreaking as the 57 top set with a full color photography featured up front, this is a very generational 1958 look here. And all you have to do if you didn't live in 1958 is just look back at some of the color photography that was being used back then, be it advertising, be it in fashion magazines, be it in car commercials. There was color TV in 1958, but it was still very lightly used. Really didn't make an impact in every household until the late 60s. But you've got a lot of vibrant colors in 1958. And even in black and white television, there were a lot of bright, vibrant colors used on TV sets because, and what I mean is like the soundstage or the newsroom, if you're watching news on television, because certain colors transformed better into black and white. For example, light blue. A lot of TV sets in the late 50s and early 60s were painted light blue because when you had a black and white camera on it, it made it look better on the TV screen back home. So if you do some research with, you know, color photography, and again, look at advertising, look at, you know, product design, look at fashion design, look at the color of cars that were coming out then. Look at the colors of actual TV sets. And I mean the ones sitting in your living room, not where, you know, a TV show was shot. Look at some of the vibrant pastel colors that were starting to flood the mainstream. And, you know, you kind of get that feel. And, you know, these colors are used a lot, you know, in flashback pictures and, you know, vintage car shows. You know, you got teal 57 Chevy Bel Airs, and you've got the really hot pink Mel's Diner signs and stuff like that. So this is very emblematic of the time. This is very much a time capsule. Like the photography kind of gave you that feel of, hey, if I close my eyes and take a big whiff, you know, I can smell the grass at Ebbets Field where Pee Wee Reese is, you know, posing to, like he's picking up a ground ball here. Well, here you can't really see the sights and the sounds and the smells of a ballpark, but you can be transported back to this explosion of color that was very prominent in the late 1950s. And you'll see a lot of these colors again used in the 1959 and 1960 sets as well, although not as much as they did in 1958. So you've got a very colorful front of the card, and this goes with all players, not just the Jerry Staley card. Let's flip the card over, and you're going to see Topps going back to some things that they did prior to 1957. We discussed how in 1957 they went to the complete major league record of the player. They got rid of cartoons. It was all just stats. The Joe Friday card, just the facts, man. Well, 58 Topps kind of goes back to what worked in earlier editions. First, you have the card number in the upper left-hand corner, and instead of the Wild Wild West Topps logo up there, you've got this goofy cap-covered baseball. It's kind of smiling back at you. It's kind of weird. But then you have the player's name and this comic book sans next to it. You have a little written biography about, in this case, Jerry Staley. But then right beneath it, you have a couple of cartoons. You have one that says, Jerry was a big winner for the Cardinals through five seasons. And then another one, last season, he posted a handsome 2.06 earned run average. That might be the first time I've ever heard an earned run average described as handsome. But handsome it was. And you'll also notice that in the cartoon on the left, Jerry is spelled with a G. And through several sources I've looked up, that's actually how he preferred his name being spelled. So the fact that it was spelled with a J on the back of the card at the top and also on the front of the card is a little bit of a goof up by the Topps people. They did spell it correctly, but his preferred spelling was with a G. But then you get to the stats, and again, they revert to what they did back in earlier editions of cards, and that is they would have a line for the previous year and then a line for his career. And also the personal information, height, weight, birth town, all that fun stuff is in a little box on the right here. And you have these horizontal backgrounds, which is something that you saw through a lot of the cards in the 1950s. So the Topps Company was using this design along with a very easy to read red, light pink, and white background. And of course, on the old cardboard stock, it's not truly white. I mean, there was some white ink added to some spots here, but you know, with the gray cardboard, it kind of turned out to be a pale white. You know, whenever we say white, it's not true white, it's just kind of this grayish white because of the cardboard stock. But this was a really nice set front and back. And if you ever bought the Topps Heritage cards from 2007, you got to see this firsthand. And I thought they did a great job. I mean, I liked what they did in 2006 with the 57 Topps design. But I remember 2007 Topps Heritage really nailed the 58 Topps design to a T. So, a very colorful front, very flawless front. Again, not quite as innovative as just the pictures that you saw in 57, but still a very memorable card set. Even though it doesn't have these great design mechanisms to it, even though there's no action shots, there's nothing really groundbreaking here. If you saw just a template of this card, you know it's from 1958. And that is really the goal of, the card companies throughout the years. Design a card that you didn't necessarily need to see the stats on the back or a copyright date or a date on a wrapper. You could just look at the design and go, ah, that's from, whatever year it is. So 58 Tops, while it is not one of the, really striking sets, it definitely commands your attention because of the varying colors and the backgrounds of these cards, a lot of up-close real pictures of players that were cropped on top of the colors, and then a really nice, informative, and kind of fun back to the card. Now, as for a little story about this card, well, why do I have Jerry Staley? I have one 1958 Topps card. How did it end up being Jerry Staley, of all people? Well, I've told you this story before, how I used to buy, and this is going back, 25 or so years ago, I would occasionally buy the boxes of, unsearched vintage baseball cards. And you would get these boxes. I remember you can get them at Pace Warehouse. That was kind of a predecessor to Sam's Club and Costco and BJ's and groups like that. But you could also order them from the Amway catalog. And most of the time, the box, this is 1990, 91. Most of the time, 98% of the cards were junk wax cards from like 86 through 89. You would occasionally get a few from 82, 83, 84 dunked in there. I remember one of the small boxes from the Amway catalog actually had about 10 cards from 1978, which again, I was 12 or 13 when I bought these. It was really cool to have those in hand because I couldn't afford a pack of 78 Tops back then. So I had practically a pack of cards in this box. And the boxes were 400 count boxes, but they only put 250 cards in there. So there would be some foam or something to kind of buffer the edges to it. But most of the time, even though as a kid, I was just happy to be ripping through a box of cards just to see what I got. And I would get that occasional pleasant surprise of a 78 Tops collection or something like that. Most of the time, looking back at it, it wasn't the greatest investment. As a card collector, I would end up getting a lot of doubles of cards because I'd already pulled, plenty of 88 Tops and 89 Donruss cards from wax packs. But there was one year where, the Amway catalog, I would every year, for Christmas, I would put the box down as one of my wants. And I remember one year, I think it was 1992 or 93, I put the Amway box down. And for some reason that year, they didn't just do the usual 250 card box. They did, I want to say it was a 500 card collection. And it was in a big flat box. I want to say it might have held 800 cards. I don't know, or maybe 600 cards. It was a very odd design for a box. It wasn't your normal baseball card box. But anyways, I get this for Christmas and I'm thrilled. Hey, I got a whole bunch of baseball cards to go through. And I open it up and just like every other collection, there's plenty of cards from like 86 through 90. And then you have a few from 82, 83, 84, 85. And when I say a few, I mean like one or two from each year, just kind of peppered in there. Well, lo and behold, in this box is this Jerry Staley card. And I am stunned because this was let me do the math real quick. This would have been a 25-year-old baseball card. Yes, it was a common card. Yes, I had no idea who Jerry Staley was. But I had a card from 1958, and it was in pretty decent condition. So that really impressed me that, through all of the, stuffing of boxes where, again, 90, 95% of the cards were cards I probably already had, to find something from 1958 in an Amway box, of all places, was really, really neat. I thought that was a real treat. So even though this is the only 58 Topps card, and I'm still kind of befuddled that that's the case, even though this is the only one I've got, I remember it well because it was such a rarity in the oddest of locations. And I've had it for over 25 years now, or about 25 years. And it's one of my favorites just because this card quite literally came out of nowhere, was surrounded by a few hundred other cards that I probably got rid of because, again, they were all the commons from the late 80s that I dumped out of my house a long time ago. But here's this one card of Mr. Goodyear himself, Jerry Staley. I still have it, and I really enjoy it. Now, real quickly on Jerry Staley, one of the fun things about doing research on players that aren't household names. You know, Pee Wee Reese, if you know anything about baseball or the Dodgers, you know who Pee Wee Reese is. And again, if you go back to our podcast from the heart of the junk wax era, basically like 1990 through 93, although, I mean, honestly, if you go back like from 88 to 93 in our podcast, you had some household names, you had some star players or superstar veterans, and that's because from that era, those are the cards that I kept. So we did a lot of shows, you know, with Ken Griffey Jr. or Frank Thomas or Nolan Ryan. And, you know, it's fun to look back at some of these players. But really, some of the best stories come from the players that you don't know much about. And Jerry Staley was a guy who was a starter with the St. Louis Cardinals. His major league career started in 1947, and he was with the Cardinals through the end of the 1954 season. And he was a pretty decent starting pitcher. 1951, he went 19-13 with a 3.81 earned run average. Believe it or not, that wasn't an all-star year for him. He was, however, an all-star for the Cardinals at age 31 and 32, respectively. In 1952 and 53, he went 17-14 with a 3.27 earned run average in 1952, 18-9 with a 3.99 earned run average in 1953. But as the case is for a lot of players, as you're getting older, and especially back then, I mean, you had starting pitchers that if they didn't go the complete nine, then they probably went 7 or 8 innings. They probably threw 120 pitches a game. And it's certainly not as specialized now as it was back then. Well, by your mid-30s, if you were still going, your arm was going to get shot eventually. And that's what happened to him. He bounced around from St. Louis to Cincinnati to the Yankees. He was actually with the Yankees in 1955, wasn't on their postseason roster in 1955. And he finds his way to Chicago in 1956. Now, he is a 35-year-old pitcher, and he's still putting up some decent numbers in relief. Well, it turns out the White Sox, and especially under Al Lopez in 1959, decide to turn him into a closer. Now, again, closers were not really all that common in 1959. The job description of the closer relief pitcher really didn't become something that was common until the late 60s. In fact, the save stat wasn't made until 1969, or wasn't officially acknowledged by Major League Baseball until 1969. So, you know, a relief pitcher or a specialist who came in just in the ninth inning to shut down an opposing team, or in some cases an eighth inning if the team was in a bit of a jam, this was new stuff. And Jerry Staley found himself starting in 1957 with the White Sox, appearing in a lot of games as a relief pitcher. He appeared in 47 games in 1957, 50 games in 1958, 67 games in 1959. He did not start any of these games. In fact, his last major league start came in the 1956 season, and he would play until 1961. So he, very much like John Smoltz, went from starter to reliever, although that's more common these days. Jerry Staley got a second lease on his baseball life by becoming essentially the closer for the Chicago White Sox during the year that they, that they made it to the World Series. They would lose to the Dodgers, but the Go-Go Sox under Bill Veeck, there's the great name in baseball again. You know, he was officially credited with 15 saves, and I say officially because that's what's on baseballreference.com. And here's a guy who was able to keep his pitching dominance going in short spurts and not as a, you know, a starter, a guy who had to throw 120 pitches and make it through 8 or 9 innings. This guy could do 12 or 15 pitches and get the job done. Well, after the 1959 season, at 39 years of age, Staley was an all-star once again in 1960. 64 games he appeared in. He was credited with, 9 saves that year. He had a 13-8 record, too. But as the magic of the White Sox started falling, so did Staley. I mean, after all, he was pushing 40. And finally, in 1961, he's bouncing around again from Chicago to Kansas City to Detroit. But really, the interesting story about Jerry Staley is how he got to the big leagues and what he did afterwards. And again, I have to give credit to the Saber people. Of course, when I say Saber, I mean SABR.org. Jim Sargent did a very thorough, to put it simply, story on Jerry Staley several years ago. And I'm not going to read through all of this. I would need another hour of your time, and I don't want to do that for you. But Jerry Staley, let me just sum it up to you this way. He was growing up outside of Vancouver, Washington. Clark County is the name of the locale. And he had just finished high school at Battleground High School. He graduated in 1938. Well, because he's in this small part of town, just out in the neck of the woods of Washington, and of course, there wasn't a major league team then. You had the Seattle Rainiers of the Pacific Coast League, but there was only so much to advanced scouting that was going on back in the late 30s and early 1940s. In fact, there really wasn't much. Ball players would, have their stories told to major league teams, and some coach or manager or somebody who had some local relevance would, get on the phone to a major league team and say, hey, you got to send somebody out here to watch this kid. That was pretty much it. So, of course, growing up in the Vancouver, Washington shadows, Jerry Staley is not seen, and he is actually working for the Alcoa Aluminum Company in Vancouver for a few years. Well, he's playing in these sandlot leagues, and at first he's a shortstop. And the reason why, according to this article, he was a shortstop, he was one of the few players who had enough arm strength to make the throw from deep in the hole to first base. Well, in his third season of the sandlot baseball, he gets moved to the pitcher's mound because, again, he's one of the few people that actually has enough velocity and strength to pitch a whole game there. And the Pioneer League, which was a very low level, a C-level league, signed him in 1941. So that's his break. And he had a phenomenal season in 1941, went 22-8. With a 2.79 earned run average for the team in Boise, Idaho in 1941. And he goes overseas. He serves in the medical corps and was involved in World War II from 1943 to 1945. Well, he comes back stateside in 1946. He's playing with the Sacramento Solons of the Pacific Coast League, and the St. Louis Cardinals at the time had an agreement with the Solons that after the war, and because, the war took so many prime players out of the country for a few years, a lot of these borderline minor league players were playing in the major leagues for a few years. Well, once the players started coming back, a lot of teams had agreements to where they could take a player or two from the Pacific Coast League or the whatever the minor league was, the International League, the American Association, whatever, and they would invite them to spring training and put them on the roster. Well, it turns out for Jerry Staley, he's the guy the Cardinals pick as the serviceman that is going to get added to their roster. So he's playing in Sacramento in 1946, has a fairly decent year, goes to spring training in 1947, and he makes the team. And he starts one game late in the season, pitches a complete game, and wins, and eventually works his way into the starting rotation starting in 1948. And I told you about his career path from then on out. A pretty solid career. Even though he never won a World Series, he was with some very good contending teams with the Cardinals early on in his career and was a very big part to the Chicago White Sox winning the American League pennant in 1959. Well, after his career ended, Staley would go back to Vancouver, to Clark County, and he was the superintendent of the Clark County Park System for 17 years. And oh, by the way, because this is back in the day when ballplayers made quite literally $10,000, $12,000, they had to have summer jobs. So what did Jerry Staley do during his summers? Well, he would work in his family's lumber mill. Can you imagine a ball player doing that? Can you imagine, you know, David Price or, I mean, anybody? Well, Skip, it's been a fun season. I'm going to go work at my family's lumber mill. The hell you will. You got to protect that arm. So Jerry Staley quite literally putting life and limb to the risk here during the offseason. But every ball player did that back in the day. But I just think it's, you know, it's very similar actually to the Pee Wee Reese story. If you recall in our 57 Tops podcast, Pee Wee Reese was playing on these sandlot teams in Louisville, Kentucky in the late 1930s. And he gets discovered by the local minor league team, the Louisville Colonels, who eventually get bought by the Boston Red Sox. And he would have been a member of the Boston Red Sox had then shortstop and manager Joe Cronin not gotten scared of his abilities and basically forced to trade to Brooklyn. It was the same thing for Jerry Staley. You know, here's a guy who probably would have been working in a lumber mill or at Alcoa Aluminum for the next 30 years of his life. That would have been fine and dandy. He would have earned a pension just like anybody else. But he gets on a sandlot team. He's the best player on the team. He gets picked up by a low-level minor league team and, you know, is able to pay his dues around wartime service as well. And he gets a huge break when the St. Louis Cardinals decide to pick him. Of all the players playing for Sacramento in 1946, he was the guy that they were going to sign. And eventually he would make his way up to the major leagues late in the 1947 season. And he would be a very productive player, a regular too, be it starter or reliever, from 1948 to 1961. And like I said, a great story too afterwards, 17 years as the superintendent of the park system for his hometown. That's great. He retired in 1982. He is a member of the Washington Sports Hall of Fame, inducted back in 1977. And Jerry Staley passed away on January 2nd, 2008. What a life, what a career, and what a neat little card here that showed up, at least in my good fortunes, in a box of a whole lot of nothing from the Amway Company as a Christmas gift back in 1992 or 93, as the case may be. Well, that's our look at 1958 Tops and the story behind this one card from that set that I have and the very unique player that is featured on that card, number 412, Jerry with a J or G, Staley, pictured here with the Chicago White Sox. Well, if you have any comments about the 1958 Tops set, about any of the players that we discussed, or just anything about the hobby in general, again, you can comment at any time on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And don't forget, we are now heard on iHeartRadio. Just check out the iHeartRadio app or iHeartRadio.com. Type Wax Ecstatic in the search window. You'll get our latest episodes plus our entire archive, much the same as iTunes and Audio Boom. All right, from 1958, we go to a slightly larger collection of mine. Well, when I say slightly, I mean I have maybe 20 cards from this time, but we will have a truly random selection. I'm curious to see who it is and what condition the card is in from the 1959 top set, which borrows a lot from the 1958 set, including the pastel color palette, but it has a very unique design to it that still holds up all these years later. So we will do that next Tuesday on a brand new edition of Wax Ecstatic. And don't forget about our Friday flashbacks, which will be posted on Friday, and we'll send you nice little reminders Saturday and Sunday on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.